This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Colin Robinson of Orr Books joins us to discuss British Labour Party Jeremy Corbyn's recent victory.
What a great moment it was for all of us. And he's not done.
We discuss a recent Supreme Court decision letting Bush officials avoid responsibility for their roles in post-9/11 racial profiling.
Yet another example of what we call the emerging police state.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
One of the bright and hopeful developments in world politics in recent months was the wide support that Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the British Labour Party, got recently in that country's election. Corbyn ran on an unabashedly left platform. His party recruited tens of thousands of young people before and after the election. Although the Conservative government of Prime Minister Theresa May is still in power, this is not likely to last long. To speak with us today about these developments in Great Britain and their relevance to the United States, where we saw a similar phenomena with the rise of Bernie Sanders, is Colin Robinson. Robinson is from Liverpool, England, lives in New York City, and is the publisher of Orr Books. Orr recently issued The Candidate by Alex Nunes, a really thrilling page-turner about Corbyn's election victory. Robinson is a supporter of the British Labour Party and has written about it for British periodicals.
Colin Robinson, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Now, you hail from working-class Liverpool, England, the home of the Beatles. Tell us why you support Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party.
Well, I didn't used to support the Labour Party. It's only quite recently that I've supported it. Under Tony Blair, it was a neoliberal, although I don't really like that word because no one's exactly sure what it means, but certainly a party that was very comfortable. I think Peter Mandelson, who was one of the leaders of Blair's Labour Party, said they were very comfortable with people getting supremely rich. And also, it was a party that supported the Iraq War, led Britain into the Iraq War on the tails of the United States. So at that time, I really had very little interest in the Labour Party. But 2 years ago, Jeremy Corbyn, who's from the left of the party, a socialist, always involved in the movement, very good on foreign policy, a real anti-imperialist, and very solidly anti-austerity, ran for the leadership of the party, and to everyone's astonishment, I think he was a 200-to-1 outsider. He won, and it might be interesting to talk about the reasons why that happened, but that completely transformed what Labour stood for. And since then, a lot of us, hundreds of thousands of people, have joined the Labour Party, and it's a really, really exciting thing.
When Corbyn and the Labour Party issued their manifesto, it was widely accepted. What is in it that made it so popular, do you think?
It was just basic social democratic demands, actually, of the sort that Bernie had advanced quite effectively when he was running against Hillary Clinton last year in the primaries. Things like free college tuition, the building of lots of council houses to deal with the homelessness crisis, a £10 minimum wage, ending privatisation of the health service, increasing the numbers of police on the beat, and paying for all of that by taxing people who were in the top 5% of earners in the population. They guaranteed that no one in the bottom 95% would have to pay any more taxes. They were going to increase corporation tax too. And there was also nationalisation of the railways and partial nationalisation of some of the utilities like water and electricity. All of these demands had been shown in opinion polls previously to have been really popular. But both Labour and the Tories felt that that was not a place they wanted to go. So when these suddenly came out as a programme in the manifesto, everyone not everyone, but large numbers of people thought, yeah, great, let's do it. Let's bring austerity to an end.
Do you personally know Jeremy Corbyn? And if so, could you tell us a bit about him as a person?
I know him a bit. I wouldn't call him a friend, but he's my MP in Islington North in London. And because he's been around on the left and so have I, we've met each other quite a few times. And I actually did have a chat with him a while ago about doing a book, and he was quite keen on that. Unfortunately, other things have got in the way since then. So I don't imagine he's had much time for writing over the past couple of years. But he's always been a dissident Labour MP. He's always been in the Labour Party. I first got to know him when I was active in the Labour Party local politics in North London. And, you know, we were fighting the cuts back then. Against Thatcher, we organised to support the miners in the 84-85 miners strike. And in all of the campaigns around apartheid and Palestinian solidarity, he was active. He's very, very good with his constituents too. I mean, Islington is a constituency where some of the population is really quite well off, but a lot of it's also poor. And I think everyone... He has a huge majority. He just increased it at the last election. I think a lot of people in his constituency think that he's been very good as a local MP for them.
The British Labour Party became a neoliberal party under Tony Blair, just as the American Democratic Party became a neoliberal party under Bill Clinton. They both were for austerity measures against the working class, deregulation, and support of imperial wars. Would you say that the Corbyn phenomena represents a rejection of neoliberalism and the Tony Blair New Labour Party, just as Bernie Sanders represents the rejection of neoliberal Clinton Democrats?
I don't think there's any question about that. I think the centre has, what Tony Blair, I think, described as the radical centre, has really fallen away in politics, both here in the US and in the UK, and actually across Europe too. It's very, very difficult for those people to mobilize any longer, because what ideas do they have? I mean, these were ideas that when they came in the late 1980s, under Reagan and Thatcher, I should say the early 80s under Reagan and Thatcher, had a bit of dynamism to them. I mean, not that I ever thought they were good myself, but you could see why people might get swept up with the idea that by financializing the economy and introducing austerity, you could create a dynamic economy that would grow and provide jobs and that wealth would trickle down. Well, none of that holds water any longer. I mean, no one believes that that's possible now. And so the politics that those people were based on has just dropped away. And I think it's an enormous opportunity for the left. I mean, it could also be an enormous opportunity for the right, and that's the situation I think that we're in at the moment. But it seems to me that the only force, and it's probably more clear here now than in the UK, although the UK underscores it, the only force which is capable of beating the right is the left. The right, the centre, the neoliberal centre of Clinton and Blair just can't do it any longer. It's got no weight.
Historically, the Democratic Party in the United States was founded some 200 years ago and represented the American slaveholding class. When and where was the Labour Party formed, and what did it stand for?
Well, the Labour Party, putting me a little bit on the spot here because my Labour histories are not as clear as it should have been, but I think the Labour Party emerged in the early part of the 20th century, and it was really formed as political representation for the trades unions. And the trade unions have always played a big part in the Labour Party. What was interesting about them, though, was that under Blair, they were very marginalised. They didn't... under previous Labour leaders, I mean, obviously you mentioned Keir Hardie, but I mean, even just Harold Wilson, the trade unions were invited into 10 Downing Street when Labour was in power to be part of the government. You know, they would be involved in the conversation about what policies were going to be introduced by a Labour government. Under Tony Blair, he didn't want anything to do with that. They were not invited into 10 Downing Street. And the result of that was that they moved to the left. So over the last 15 years, there's been a sharp move to the left in the British trade unions. And it was that shift that helped to cement Corbyn's victory in the leadership election 2 years ago.
Colin, I understand that the Labour Party recruited tens of thousands of young persons, both before and after the election. How do you explain the party's popularity, and do you think there's an analogy to all the young persons in the United States who supported Bernie Sanders?
I mean, I'm sure that there is. And I think there are a number of factors involved in this. I mean, in a sort of big epochal scale, I think the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the wall coming down in 89, meant that socialism was no longer tied to a pretty and pleasant picture of the left that Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union represented in its latter days. The left kind of broke free from that shackle. The demands that Bernie and Jeremy are putting forward, which are, basic social democratic demands, they don't seem new to me. I mean, I remember when I was growing up in Britain in the 60s, those things were just pretty commonplace. But if you're 20 now, actually they seem like quite new ideas, and they're exciting. So I think that was part of the reason that young people have gathered around people like Bernie and Jeremy. The other thing is, which I think has been really, really important in Labour's campaign in June this year, was the replacement of mainstream media with social media. People are not reliant any longer on getting their news from right-wing newspapers and broadcast companies. The media's traditionally been firmly on the side of the right, whatever Donald Trump might say. I mean, it's owned by billionaires. And they've always acted as a filter to keep progressive ideas out of public discussion. But social media has really broken that apart. And I think a lot of these young people, they're not just getting their news from social media, but they're also organizing through social media. And the rallies that Jeremy was able to have in the run-up to June the 8th, which were huge and organized at the last moment, all of that stuff happened on the internet. And it was great.
Yeah, because the press in England was pretty terrible. I mean, a lot of it is owned by Murdoch, the guy that owns the New York Post. And even the liberal press, like The Guardian, did not support Jeremy. So I totally understand what you're saying. But I wanted to ask you a question about the Labour Party. The Labour Party is an actual membership organization, as opposed to the American Democratic Party, which is largely a fundraising machine. You have been living in the United States now for quite some time, Colin. Do you think we need our own party, like a Labour Party, a membership party?
I mean, definitely. There's no question about that. I mean, the Labour Party's internal democracy was eviscerated by Tony Blair, but it was never reduced to the state of the Democratic Party, which is, to someone coming from Britain, the Democratic Party is just a complete mystery. It doesn't seem to operate like a political party at all. It's basically a kind of franchise that comes together once every 4 years to throw someone into the presidential race. And there doesn't seem to be any bottom-up control in the Democratic Party at all. And that's really what's needed. I mean, what you want is a party where people join, they go along to branch meetings in their neighborhoods, they discuss policy, they vote on it. Those votes then go to a conference. On the basis of that, the conference draws up a manifesto, and that's the manifesto that the party runs in the election on. That's a democratic system, with a small d. There's nothing like that here. So either the Democratic Party has to be reformed, which I could see is like a big task, or a third party has to emerge, you know, which is run on those kind of principles. I mean, why have primaries? What is there written in stone that we have to have primaries? Why can't you just have a membership organization that votes on who's going to be the presidential candidate, put them forward and let them run? And then they're accountable to the membership of the organization. The Labour Party now has 600,000 members. It's the largest political party on the left in Europe. I mean, when you think about that, that would be the equivalent of it, because Britain's, what, a fifth of the size of the United States. That would be like a Democratic Party of, what, 3 million members? Could you imagine if you had 3 million people participating actively in the Democratic Party and voting and holding their representatives to account? What an extraordinary force that could be. So, yeah, I mean, the United States definitely needs that. And I can see it's going to be a struggle, but it's, in my view, it's the only way that that kind of formation, that kind of movement linked to a party, it's about a movement, really, which then has political expression in a party. It's only that which is going to be capable of beating these right-wingers who are, you know, occupying government at the moment.
Colin, I understand that Jeremy Corbyn has a long history of opposing British imperial interventions, such as the Iraq War you mentioned, and solidarity with Palestinians. Can you contrast that to Bernie Sanders' positions on these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think Bernie is much more focused on domestic policy. I mean, I think Bernie's probably pushed his support for the Palestinians as far as it's possible in mainstream American politics. But the debate's much more circumscribed here. I mean, Jeremy has, you know, going back to the battle in the 70s for the Troops Out movement in Ireland, you know, he was very supportive of that. I think, you know, he supported a united Ireland. That allowed him to have a relationship with the leadership of Sinn Féin, which was the main party in the north fighting for a united Ireland. And I think that allowed him to have a very helpful role in the peace process that took place in Northern Ireland, which has actually been really quite a success. It was the way that Jeremy was able to have access to those people that was, you know, partly instrumental in pushing that along. He got a lot of criticism for that, and he also got a lot of criticism because he was quite prepared to talk to people like Hamas and Hezbollah. You know, he would go along to meetings with them and say, you have to be part of the solution here. Again, you know, very, very ferociously attacked for that. But you know, I think a lot of people think, yeah, well, he's right. I mean, you can't actually sort out these issues without being involved in conversations with these kinds of people. And I think one of the things that was really, really sort of amazing and just extraordinary, really, and something that I'd be very skeptical as to whether Bernie would have done, was that in the days after the Manchester bombing, you know, which is a terrible thing, and obviously it's like a tragedy, quite a lot of young girls were killed. But traditionally, British politicians would have completely steered clear of bringing that into a political discussion. They would have just, you know, fallen over each other to ferociously condemn the people who were responsible for it, and that would be that. But actually, Jeremy went out and he gave a speech, and he said, this is in no way exonerates the people who were responsible for this action. It was a terrible thing that they did. But if you don't see that this is linked to British foreign policy, then you're actually misunderstanding the situation. These things are connected. And, you know, the way that we've behaved in Iraq and Libya and in relation to the Palestinians has an effect on our security at home. That was regarded, it just took people's breath away. But within 2 days, there were opinion polls showing that large majorities of people agreed with him. I mean, it's just not, in a way, it's so obvious. So why is it that politicians like Bernie or the Democrats aren't prepared to come out and say that our situation here in terms of the risk that we face from attacks is related to what we're doing over there? It seems such an obvious thing to say to me.
Because they get eviscerated in the corporate media here.
he did in, you know, he was called a terrorist sympathizer in Britain. But it's not washing any longer.
Colin, you are the publisher of OR Books, OR, either or. In fact, you published a book that Michael Ratner and I wrote some years ago called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. And that book went on to be published all over the world, really. Well, I'm holding in my hand another book that you've recently come out with that I'm really eager to read. I understand it's like a thriller, a page-turner. It's called The Candidate, Jeremy Corbyn's Improbable Path to Power by Alex Nunes. Talk to us a bit about the book, would you please?
Well, this is an account of Jeremy's success in the leadership campaign 2 years ago, and then there are details of his fighting off a challenge in a leadership campaign last fall, and in a new edition which is coming out in August and is going out into the bookstores, we'll also be covering, Alex will be covering what happened in the 2008 election. But it's an account of how this extraordinary development in British politics happened, and it really is an amazing story because it came about for three reasons, really. One was that there were these very powerful social movements in Britain against austerity, looking for a political home. The second was, as I'd mentioned earlier, that the trade unions had shifted to the left. But the third thing, which was really remarkable, was that a number of rule changes were introduced into the Labour Party covering the way in which the leader was elected. Previously, it had been an electoral college where the MPs, so there are just a few hundred of them, got a third of the votes. The trade unions, with many millions of members, got a third of the votes. And the party members got a third of the votes. In order to get rid of the influence of the trade unions, the right of the party was pushing that the trade union shouldn't get this block vote in the electoral college that they'd previously had. And so the union said, well, all right, we'll give up our block vote if the MPs will give up theirs, and we'll just have one member, one vote. So if you're a trade union member and you're affiliated to the Labour Party, you get one vote. If you're a member of the Labour Party, you get one vote. And if you're an MP, you get one vote. This proposal was largely opposed by the left and supported by the right. But what happened was, when it was introduced, it hugely reduced the influence of the MPs, who'd always generally been right-wing, and very much increased the influence of the membership and the trade unionists who were involved in the party. So a thing which was opposed by the left and supported by the right turned out to be of enormous benefit to the left and actually terrible for the right. It's such a dramatic turnaround. I mean, you really couldn't have made it up. That's part of the story that Alex tells in this book. And it's great. It really is a page-turner. And the leadership of the party have read it and really like it. You know, they've given us a lot of great endorsements, and they've given Alex a lot of access for the updated versions of it. And it just won a prize this weekend. It won the Bread and Roses Award, which is given by the Federation of Radical Booksellers in the UK. So it's been really a big hit for us. And, you know, I'm so used to publishing, you know, books that don't really work about terrible situations, you know, sort of lose-lose situations, if you know what I mean. And here we've got a book which is about really something wonderful, and it's selling. That's a win-win situation, right? So that's, you know, they don't come along very often.
It's called The Candidate by Alex Nunes, N-U-N-N-S, or book, put it out.
Congratulations.
And,
I'm eager to read it. Thank you so much for doing that. Colin, do you think that the Theresa May government will fall? And do you think Jeremy Corbyn could be the next British prime minister?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. They will do everything that they can to avoid Jeremy forming a government, because this would be a real threat to vested interests in the UK. I mean, this is not, you know, a rerun of Tony Blair. This is someone who is serious about taking money from rich people and giving it to poor people. And, you know, rich people are very powerful. They will try everything that they can to avoid that happening. So this deal with the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, where they basically agreed to support the Conservative Party in order to protect, to create some kind of majority in the House of Commons, is quite fragile. This is a very right-wing grouplet from the north of Ireland, socially very illiberal, and really, you know, quite parochial. So to have your government resting on their support is quite tricky for the Tories. On the other hand, it would be like turkeys voting for Christmas if they went to an election now. Those Tory MPs are not interested in having an election at this point in time. They've got to try and reassemble, try and figure out what their new strategy is. Maybe think about replacing Theresa May in, you know, perhaps the end of this year or the, you know, sometime next year, so they've got a more plausible candidate. Yeah, just try and cobble together a strategy which is capable of winning. And that's a big challenge for them. They need some time to do it. I don't think that it's very likely that Jeremy's going to be in number 10 this year, but you never know. And I think what he understands, and it's true, is that the route to Labour taking over, and especially the route to them being able to implement the programme that they promised, is through the movement. It's not parliamentary thing. If they can mobilize people, if they can get the trade unions involved, and if they can get people out on the streets, organized in their communities, then there's a possibility that they can get the Tories out and they could actually implement what would be, you know, this is not revolution, but it's certainly a strong socialist program in the UK. And, you know, if that happened in my lifetime, I would die a happy man.
And so would I. Colin Robinson, it's just been a delight for Heidi and I to have you on Law & Disorder. We wish you every best with the new Orr book, The Candidate. And we look forward to talking to you again, particularly if there are more positive developments in your homeland.
Thank you, Colin.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Colin.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The United States Attorney General Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions recently testified before the United States Senate, avoiding most of the questions that were posed to him. In response to this, the poet Raymond Nat Turner wrote a poem about Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions called Low Regard. Let's hear it.
Low regard. He kept testaline ways less than lackluster, feigned brain farts for 5-minute filibuster, arch races representing antebellum South, came whistling Dixie out his other mouth. Clever cracker reconstructing the stone wall, oinking 26 times, I do not recall. Tell me, is it blame game or race card, fueling my low regard for Beauregard? Voter suppression, his crackling sound, like black churches burning to the ground. Maybe it's his framing of the Marion Three, longing to return to days of Robert E. Lee. Is it his bogus prosecutions for voter fraud while subprime predators loot and maraud? Maybe it's his belief in superiority of whites or waging lightning war against civil rights. Tell me, is it blame game or race card, fueling my low regard for Beauregard? Voter suppression, his crackling sound, like black churches burning to the ground. Brooks Brothers Klansmen in word and deed would sport sheets if they didn't smoke weed. Oh, lizard, superior wizard, exalted cyclops, green lighting Klansmen call killer cops. Beauregard stonewalling ain't no mystery. Historically, the bass-ackward side of history. Tell me, is it blame game or race card? Fueling my low regard for Beauregard. Voter suppression is crackling sound like black churches burning to the ground.
The Supreme Court recently reversed a federal appeals court ruling that former high-level Bush administration officials may be sued for their roles in the post-9/11 profiling and abuse of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian men. The case is Ziegler v. Abbasi, formerly Turkman v. Ashcroft. After the 9/11 attacks, hundreds of non-citizens were rounded up solely on the basis of their race, religion, ethnicity, and immigration status. They were held in extremely restrictive confinement and physically and psychologically abused. The court held that high-level government officials who implement and create clearly unconstitutional practices alleged to be based on national security are nonetheless shielded from liability. However, the court did allow plaintiffs the opportunity to prove their case against prison warden Dennis Hasty, finding that the complaint's allegations, quote, plausibly show the warden's deliberate indifference to the abuse plaintiffs suffered while held at the MDC. The claims against the warden will be sent back to the lower courts for an opportunity to show that prison administrators are not entitled to the same immunity given to high-level officials in the case. Joining us to talk about the decision is Senior Managing Attorney Shane Kajdal from the Center for Constitutional Rights. His cases there include challenges to the indefinite detention of men at Guantanamo and domestic immigration sweeps. He has been counsel in major CCR cases challenging the material support statute, the low rate of African-American firefighter hiring in New York City, and the NSA's warrantless surveillance program. Shane, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a while. Shane, the Supreme Court's recent dismissal of your client's claims was very disappointing. Can you tell us what it means?
Sure. Basically, it means that it's going to be very difficult to sue any high-level federal officials, you know, cabinet members like the people that were being sued here, for damages for violations of constitutional rights. That's what this case fundamentally was about. Most people are kind of surprised to hear that you couldn't sue a state official or a local official for violating your constitutional rights until after the Civil War. Congress got the power to allow for damages lawsuits but in the Civil War amendments, and Congress passed the first series of Civil Rights Acts after the Civil War to allow you to sue, say, a state warden or a mayor or somebody like that for damages if they, say, violated your First Amendment rights or your Fifth Amendment rights to due process or so forth, right? For a violation that's already taken place, you can, you know, or something that's ongoing, if you're harmed, you can recover damages, money for the amount of harm that you suffered. But so most people are a little surprised to hear that that didn't happen until the Civil War. Most people are even more surprised to hear that for federal officials, you weren't allowed to do that until the 1970s. There was a case called Bivens versus six unnamed individual
agents.
Federal Bureau of Narcotics agents, mouthful, where for the first time the court said, you know, if we're looking at a constitutional violation after the fact, sometimes damages are the only way to repair the injury and to provide a disincentive for law enforcement or federal officials to violate your rights in the first place, right? It's damages or nothing, in the memorable phrase from one of the concurrences in that case, right? So, you know, the Supreme Court created essentially this right to sue for damages in 1971. The lower courts extended it quite a bit, but the Supreme Court only really recognized it in that kind of Fourth Amendment context, search and seizures, in prison brutality context, and in a kind of limited gender discrimination context. And after the
Rehnquist court kind of began in the 1980s, and Reagan got all his appointments on there, and the court took a big conservative turn. The court started nibbling back the ability to sue federal officials for damages. And what we saw last week, I think, is kind of maybe the final blow. The court is basically saying that except for things that look exactly like the three kind of violations that the Supreme Court had recognized in the past, we're not going to recognize any sort of new right to sue federal officials. We're grandfathering that stuff in, but anything kind of new, we're not going to accept.
Shane, this decision reversed the earlier ruling by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, can you tell our listeners what the facts were and what that decision allowed for?
Sure. So this lawsuit started a very long time ago, right after 9/11, and it was basically concerned the mistreatment and miscategorization of people who were swept into immigration detention right after the attacks. As you can kind of remember, there were a broad kind of number of immigration sweeps. About 1,200 people in the first batch got swept in, and basically if you were a Muslim man from a short list of countries in either the Arab world or South Asia, you were labeled as of interest to the terrorism investigation. And here in New York, that meant you were kept in horrible supermax conditions for the most part in the MDC out in Brooklyn, the Metropolitan Detention Center. And because the guards were told these people are of special interest to the terrorism investigation, they were brutalized, right? Now, one of the key kind of issues in the case was what was called the hold until cleared policy. These folks, even though there was no reason to suspect them individually of terrorism other than this kind of racial and religious profiling, they were all essentially held until the FBI could investigate their individual cases and cleared them of any link to terrorism. So even though a lot of people accepted voluntary deportation or lost their immigration cases and were ready to go back to their countries, they were held here for 3-4 months, again, in really brutal conditions. Now, unfortunately, the Court of Appeals already ruled many years ago that we couldn't sue over the pretext of using immigration detention for people who weren't here lawfully, didn't have documents, right? We couldn't use the pretext of bringing people in and holding them in immigration detention. We couldn't complain about that hold until cleared policy, basically. The idea that they were not really holding them for immigration reasons, but to check out whether they were, you know, terrorists despite, you know, no evidence leading to that suspicion other than the racial profiling, that we couldn't sue over. But what we could sue over, we thought, was the prison brutality, and particularly the formulation of this policy by Ashcroft and other high-level folks.
Bob Mueller,
the FBI.
Back with us.
That's right. That's right. And Robert Ziegler, the head of the INS at the time, right? Now, these were all sort of high-level officials at the very top of the Justice Department. You know, as a practical matter, I think Ashcroft probably had the most to do with formulating this policy, but they were the ones who decided that everybody who was Muslim from the short list of countries was going to be held in maximum security conditions. And what this meant as a practical matter was that you were in solitary, lights on 23 hours a day, you were strip searched, going, you know, even in and out of immigration court. It's one thing to be searched on the way into immigration court. It's another, I guess, to be searched on the way back out, right? But the you know, a whole variety of kind of physical brutality as well.
Yeah, the one that sticks in my mind was that bloody American flag printed on a T-shirt. Mm-hmm. The T-shirt's pinned to the wall, and these guys have their faces smashed into the T-shirt.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these allegations weren't believed by the government or maybe even the public when they first came out, right? So all of our guys said that there was a T-shirt that said these colors don't run with an American flag printed on it, and it was taped to the wall of the loading dock where the vans would come in. The concrete wall had this T-shirt taped to it, and guys would be taken in, and their faces would be smashed into the T-shirt every time when it was kind of your introduction to the MDC, right? And the bloodied T-shirt, you know, continued to hang there as more and more people were brought in.
Perfectly symbolic and poetic, I thought. Mm-hmm. Really, yeah. An introduction to American justice with respect to Arabs and Muslims.
Yeah, here's the interesting thing about supermax facilities there. One of the reasons the lights are on all the time is because there's pervasive surveillance. So because there were videotapes of everything, pretty much everything that our clients said about the brutality that they experienced was documented, right? But basically, as the case progressed, the kind of main issue right now that the Supreme Court decided against us was, could we sue Ashcroft, Mueller, and Ziegler for formulating this policy. And basically, the Supreme Court said no. It's interesting because prison brutality was one of the types of claims that the Supreme Court had recognized in the past. So you would think it would be grandfathered. It wouldn't be a new type of Bivens claim. But they said no. Here there are a bunch of factors that that make this case distinct.
Shane, I just want to go back briefly to something you mentioned in terms of the evidence, the so-called evidence, that was brought against some of these individuals and that caused them to be in detention. We heard after 9/11 that persons often brought who were tortured were done so because of bounties offered in different countries. What kinds of evidence? I understand there were citizen tips reporting such activities as, quote, Arabs working long hours or Middle Eastern men renting post office boxes. Is that on a par of what was enough to bring these individuals in?
Sure. Those are some examples from this class of special interest detainees, right? You know, oh, I saw a bunch of Arab men at the 24-hour grocery, you know, around the corner, right? We had clients who were kind of, you know, turned in by sort of bitter ex-spouses, you know, landlords who called in saying, you know, I would hate to have, you know, somebody, you know, who lived in my apartment have some link to the attacks and not have reported it, right? I mean, anything that you know, could have led to somebody, you know, who working here out of status to being arrested, right? You know, the problem is, none of that stuff rises to the level of creating actual suspicion of any link to terrorism. But once guys got into the immigration system, if you were Muslim, if you were from an Arab country or the Indian subcontinent, you were labeled as of interest to the terrorism investigation. And because of policies that Ashcroft and Mueller and Ziegler signed off on, you ended up in these conditions where you were brutalized and they knew it was happening. And they knew that these people had no connection to terrorism. You know, the kind of bottom line after it all happened was that out of the 1,200 in the first group of special interest detainees, only three people were charged with any kind of crime, and it was crimes like credit card fraud and things like
right.
that, even nothing at all related to terrorism.
I understand that Justices Kagan and Sotomayor recused themselves from the case, so they could not participate in the ruling, but Justice Breyer, joined by Justice Ginsburg, read a pretty powerful dissent from the bench. Can you briefly highlight what they said before? I know Michael has some related questions to ask.
Sure. I mean, Breyer's dissent basically says that, you know, there's nothing terribly novel about allowing this kind of case to go forward. And to the extent that there are worries about kind of revealing the internal deliberations of sensitive deliberations of cabinet ministers or of creating a chilling effect because they know in the future that they might end up, you know, having their depositions taken about these kind of policies, or that national security generally creates a sort of disincentive to allow this kind of case to go forward. Well, Breyer said, basically, we have other doctrines that allow those concerns to be addressed, particularly judicial control of the discovery process. You know, judges can allow your ability to explore in the files of the government or question high-level government officials to be limited or kind of cabined. You know, you can explore kind of gradually that kind of thing, which is, you know, not exceptional at all. In litigation, oftentimes material and discovery is held under seal until it's clear that it's relevant and that releasing it publicly wouldn't cause harm to national security. You know, and look here, the allegations are that these officials knew what they were doing was wrong and wasn't justified by national security pretty much from the get-go. So it's a really weird thing for Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, to say, well, I think we need to protect the ability to have these confidential discussions, and we need to protect the ability to respond any way officials see fit in a time of crisis from an after-the-fact damages suit where a court is going to have control over the discovery process. And then on top of that, a doctrine called qualified immunity will protect any officials who acted in good faith and didn't know what they were doing was illegal.
Yeah, it's particularly dismaying because Kennedy is looked upon as the swing justice. Mm-hmm. One of the sentences in Breyer's dissent that struck me, and I want to read it for the audience, is Breyer said, in wartime as well as in peacetime, it's important in a civilized society that the judicial branch of the nation's government stand ready to afford a remedy for the most flagrant and patently unjustified, unconstitutional abuses of official power. They just couldn't make it, could they?
Mm-hmm. Right. I think one of the interesting things the majority said was that, you know, you could have gone ahead and addressed this issue, you know, not by a damages case that lasts 15 years and has all this discovery, but by, you know, seeking habeas relief or injunctive relief from the courts when all the violations were happening. And one of the interesting things about the case is actually that part of the policies that were set by the Justice Department were designed to prevent that from happening. So there was a communications blackout thrown over all these folks. They weren't allowed to kind of talk to their families. They weren't allowed to talk to lawyers for a long period of time. Then when lawyers finally got in to see them, they could only talk to them once a week. The cases in the immigration courts were removed from the docket, so journalists didn't know they were happening. It took months to get to the bottom of what was happening here, but all of this stuff, this communications blackout, was clearly designed to prevent the ability to go in and challenge it while it was happening. So here again, damages are nothing. It was after-the-fact relief is the only real check that we have on these sorts of abuses.
I remember when a lot of this was happening, the panic from families and community members wondering where a lot of these men were. It was a horrible time.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was going on in Brooklyn.
Right, and New Jersey as well.
The CCR started the lawsuit only 5 months after 9/11. It was really bad times, and these bad times continue up to 2017. Mm-hmm. Shane, this brings me to a broader question. Is this loss that we suffered last week in this ruling, you think that's part of a trend that's going to allow increasing executive abuse?
I think it's the tail end of the trend, really. I think for anything involving high-level federal officials, for anything that, you know, purportedly is a challenge to a sort of broad policy rather than the actions of rogue low-level officials, you know, who don't attend fancy soirees with the Supreme Court justices or not part of that, you know, high-level elite of Washington power players, you're not going to be able to sue them after the fact for damages. And I think, you know, when you look at what concerned the Supreme Court here, that they didn't want people to be able to dig in, litigants to be able to dig into internal deliberations of the executive branch. Think about how that might play out with a damages case about the Muslim ban, for instance, right?
That was my next question.
Yeah. I mean, it's precisely those internal deliberations that might reveal that, in fact, there was no national security purpose to the Muslim ban and that pernicious discrimination really was behind it, that a desire to signal to what do they call dog whistle to Trump's, you know, core supporters that this was about discrimination against Muslims, about oppressing Muslims, was behind the whole thing, right? And yet, the idea that there are high-level internal deliberations setting a policy that is purportedly about national security, all those are checkboxes that the Supreme Court will used to throw out any damages case after the fact. And so if you can't challenge it on the fly, then being able to challenge it after the fact is pretty tough at this point. So I think what we're looking at is a tail end of a long pattern that really started with the Rehnquist Court, where they didn't want to say we're eliminating the ability to sue the federal government for constitutional violations, but we're going to do it in practice in the usual way that that conservative judges exercise their power, which is to hide it behind layers and layers of legal doctrine that take, you know, 5 minutes to explain, and every layperson is bored by the time you're done explaining it, you know. But the bottom line is no accountability after the fact for these kind of violations.
They subvert the Constitution and democratic rights even as they pretend to be upholding them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the most practical consequence of this loss is that Ashcroft won't have to sit for a deposition, which was, you know, basically due once the case got done with this round of appeals. So we won't get to hear from his own mouth what his level of knowledge was about, you know, and when he knew about the fact that none of these people had any evidence linking them to terrorism, that there was no reason to suspect them of links to terrorism. You know, and governments do this kind of thing in a crisis, not typically because they are, you know, reflexively trying to be super cautious, but in part because it looks good politically, right? You can't have, you know, a surprise attack basically like 9/11 and then look like you spend the next couple months looking like you were surprised. You have to be able to tell the newspapers we got 1,200 people who are suspected terrorists, right? And if you drop a veil of secrecy, a communications blackout over them, it makes it easier to be able to argue to the press that these are in fact suspected terrorists. It takes a lot of pressure that ought to be there from the voting public on elected officials to do their jobs better. It takes a lot of that pressure and removes it. And, you know, this is one reason it makes us less safe.
The Supreme Court upheld in part Trump's ban, and they're going to look at the whole thing in October. And I wanted to ask you about what you thought about last week's partial ban on Muslims and Arabs coming to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird sort of slapdash kind of opinion. And, you know, that was my first reaction a little bit to the Turkmen opinion or the Abbasi opinion, because the lower courts took a much closer look at all the factors here. But with the travel ban, you know, I think one of the key things about it is that allowing that kind of ban that doesn't seem to have any justification in national security seems only directed at kind of discrimination against a religion. And there seems to be clear evidence that that was what motivated it from the get-go. Allowing that kind of ban injures all Americans, right? It injures every American citizen who's a Muslim because it shows that their federal government is discriminating against their religion. And so for the Supreme Court to say, well, if you don't have any pre-existing, well-defined relationship with the United States, you're just some foreigner who wants to come here on a tourist visa or something like that, well, we're going to allow them to cancel your visa because you just don't have any right to enter the United States. Well, that completely ignores the fact that the kind of central establishment clause violation here is that the federal government has taken it upon itself to discriminate against one particular religion, which is one of the key things that the founding generation thought the federal government ought not to be able to do, right? This is the land that was settled by people who, you know, came here in large part for religious liberty.
Right? Well, and the other federal court that ruled on it said that Trump's edict exceeded his powers as an executive. So it was just not First Amendment religious rights, but the executive power, which has now been reasserted. And that's what's so frightening to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. The Ninth Circuit, I think, basically kind of carved it down to the question of whether there was authority to discriminate like this between nations under the immigration statutes itself. Although, you know, again, that's the kind of territory where, you know, the court might be more likely to recognize that this is just an area where there's an awful lot of executive authority traditionally, right? But, of course, what concerns us all about it is that it is really just a dog whistle. There's no national security concern that's animating it, that it's really fundamentally about showing Trump's core supporters that he's willing to do something appallingly discriminatory against Muslims, whether they're here in the U.S. or abroad.
Shortly after you filed the Abbasi case, I co-edited a book with William Kunstler's two daughters called The Emerging Police State, and it was a collection of writings and speeches that Kunstler had given. Kunstler, of course, is one of the founders of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Michael Ratner, who was at that time president, wrote the introduction to the book, and Michael and I got a lot of heat because we called it The Emerging Police State. The book came out in 2004. Looking backwards now over the last 13 years, you think we titled that book accurately?
I expected the concern was with the word emerging.
What do you think has been nailed down in the last 13 years, which makes it even more emerging than it was 13 years ago? For example, I was concerned about the obliteration of the Posse Comitatus Act and the super militarization of local police departments, mm-hmm. increased surveillance, about which you know a lot. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that scare me. You know, given now that we've got Trump and this ultra-right wing in power, and what could happen in this country if there's an economic crisis or if there is a terrorist attack or if there's another war, say, against Iran, I think our democratic rights are really quite frail right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think militarization is probably the best word to kind of summarize all of these developments, right? In the surveillance arena, everything is kind of analogized to doing, you know, surveillance of the enemy on the battlefield. You know, ditto for immigration policy or detention of terrorism suspects, right? It's all justified as being, you know, somehow analogous to what you would do with foreign soldiers in a war. Or, you know, it's interesting, right? I mean, I think one of the comparisons I always like to draw is to the reaction to terrorist events in the UK, where there is a, you know, ethnically sort of, you know, non-native English kind of, you know, population, but they are second and third generation there, and so they're citizens. And so any oppressive measure that's put in place there, everybody knows it applies to everybody, right? Here in the United States, we've got a gigantic population of non-citizens, right? 10 plus 6%. On top of that, about 10, 11 million folks who are not only not citizens but not documented, don't have visas, don't have immigration status here, right? And that allows the government to push forward these kind of militarization policies that say these people are like, you know, the German soldiers that we were fighting in World War II. They really shouldn't have any rights. We're going to put them in, you know, some kind of system of detention that's modeled on a military system where they don't have any of the same rights as you might, you citizens, but you don't have to worry about that because you're citizens, right? And that's one of the kind of unique things, unique sorts of abuses that our very kind of immigration-friendly country, I suppose, at some level allows for, right? We are one of the few places that has such a large population of non-citizens. It allows governments to do these kind of, symbolic, these national security theater kind of measures and yet reassure citizens that, you know, there aren't going to be spillover effects against them. Of course, that kind of argument doesn't really work in the surveillance arena, and that may explain why people maybe are more up in arms about that kind of thing across the board than they are about, say, Guantanamo or what happened to these poor special interest detainees 15 years ago.
Shane, we just have a few minutes remaining. Are there other cases that the center is bringing or that are pending that we should know about?
Well, we're working on a whole bunch of immigration arena cases, which we'll have more to say about, I guess, when they're launched. You know about the long-running kind of remedy phase of the stop-and-frisk case, which I wish I knew more detail about and I could tell you about, but certainly look for that. Right. And then, of course, you know, Guantanamo and everything else that hadn't really changed under Obama. There are only 41 men left there, but it's a huge, huge challenge now for us, 15, 16 years in, to figure out where the weak points are and try to get some motion towards getting guys out who are never going to be charged.
Yeah, it's frightening to think that Guantanamo has not yet been closed down and that we've got a president who says that he likes torture and that torture works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Trump's statements about torture were really interesting. I think there was that key statement where he said, you know, of course it works, and even if it didn't work, they deserve it. This gets at a key thing about the demographic of voters who supports torture. You find, like, a lot of support among evangelicals, and this has been pretty consistent from, you know, more than a decade back in the polling, a lot of support from people who think that it's justified as punishment. They assume that the people against whom it is directed are guilty, and they think that it's perfectly fair to take terrorists and torture them. Right. So that's how it computes in people's minds. They don't think about it as a mechanism, which it typically is in practice, for producing false confessions. And you know, most Americans have never heard that argument, even that torture doesn't work, that it is not a reliable means for producing information. They've seen 24. They've seen Homeland. They've seen all these shows where it actually, you know, produces immediate results and just keeps the interrogator up at night afterwards. Right. But the reality is that in practice, it's completely useless. It doesn't produce reliable information. It tends to drown out the accurate information with tons and tons of noise, and that, you know, putting that kind of practical thing to one side, it's very often directed at people who are innocent, right? We know that a third of the people in the CIA detention program, supposedly, you know, the true worst of the worst, right? The folks that they wouldn't even tell people they were holding, that they held in secret black sites in random different countries, a third of those people are out. They're released, right? We know at this point, we've got a long track record that that not only was, you know, no valuable intelligence produced by this extensive torture program, but also that an awful lot of people were tortured who had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, and the documentation on that could all be destroyed. It's coming up for a decision by Trump. Michael Ratner used to say that unless these torturers are prosecuted, you're not going to put an end to it. Mm-hmm. And none of them have been prosecuted.
Shane, remind listeners how they can find out more about the center's work.
Sure. Well, you can Google Center for Constitutional Rights, or you can type in ccrjustice.org in your browser, and our webpage is full of useful information. It's actually a pretty nice webpage and getting better all the time.
We look forward to a future update with you. It's always great to have you in our studios.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.